Hey everyone, I'm Jonathan Goree, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you to today's educational activity, Revolutionizing Pain Care, Applying the Latest Updates in Opioid REMS Education to Your Practice. Today's program is supported by an educational grant from Opioid Analgesic REMS Program Companies. Today's program is brought to you by CME Outfitters, an award-winning accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians worldwide. I also want to encourage everyone to join our live X conversation, and you can follow us at CME Outfitters on X. And so again, I'll introduce myself. So I'm Jonathan Goree. I am an anesthesiologist and a chronic pain physician. I work at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, and I've been here for 10 years. I hold a couple of other titles, but I spend about 50% of my time doing clinical care and a good amount of my time doing research. And I'm really excited to join you on this webinar with two of my really good friends and also esteemed colleagues. And I will allow Dr. Chapman to introduce himself.
I'm Michael Chapman. I'm a clinical psychologist and a trainer of pain medicine fellows at NYU, and have been working in REMS for about 17 years.
And now we'll move on to Dr. Singh.
Hello, I'm Dr. Vinita Singh. I am chief of pain medicine at Emory University. And I'm an associate professor in the Department of Anesthesiology and really happy to be here.
Thanks to you both. They both were super humble in their introductions. We're talking hundreds of research articles just in those two panelists alone. So, and people who have had influences on the pain world internationally. So really excited for this conversation. I think it's going to be great. We're going to move on to our learning objectives. The first is to incorporate knowledge of physiologic mechanisms and biopsychosocial factors influencing pain development, persistence, and management into clinical assessment and appropriate management of pain. The second is to incorporate strategies from the 2022 CDC guideline for prescribing opioids into the development of safe and effective pain management plans for patients with acute, subacute, and chronic pain. The third learning objective is to incorporate the DSM-5 criteria into the identification and diagnosis of opioid use disorder in patients prescribed opioids for acute and chronic pain. And as I go through those learning objectives, we're going to go through that and more. I think we have some exciting topics. I think we're going to have some spirited debates because there's some things that we may disagree on, but hopefully we'll all learn from those conversations. I'm going to start with a survey question, and you may have to scroll down on your screen depending on the size of your screen to kind of see the answers. But the question is, what are the most challenging aspects of treating patients with pain in your practice? All right, and now we've got the answers. I'm going to scroll down and look. It looks like the number one answer was patient comorbidities. That's something we're definitely going to cover. Loss of response to treatment. I know Dr. Singh is going to talk a little bit about kind of more advanced options for pain medicines. Prior authorizations, I completely agree. I probably spend way too much of my time getting prior authorizations for both medications and for advanced procedures, especially methadone. For whatever reason, I'm having to do a lot recently. Lack of time, knowledge of drugs, and then kind of coming in at the end, staffing challenges and drug positioning. All right, I'm going to go over some basic topics really quickly, and then we're going to get into more of a conversational style. And so The first thing is really looking at this slide and really showing how acute pain really turns into chronic pain. And I always think of this, and when I explain it to my fellows here at the University of Arkansas, that chronic pain is really, honestly, it's dysfunctional pain. So functional pain is really acute pain. Acute pain is when we have an injury which causes inflammation or which causes some sort of damage to our body. And that fires nociceptive fibers. But then if that pain continues over time and continues after that area of our body heals, then we have actual structural remodeling and structural changes to how we submit that signal or how we transmit that signal from our periphery into our central nervous system and into our brain. And when that happens, we actually transform that pain from acute pain into chronic pain. And one of the things that we'll touch on is there's a lot of differences in the efficacy of certain drugs to treat acute pain versus the efficacy to treat chronic pain. This slide is a little bit, has a lot of information on it, and I don't want to go through specific details of this slide, but what this slide really does is in the top left corner, it shows you where tissue injury happens, and you can follow the dotted lines and the straight lines and really understand all of the messenger molecules and things that happen and changes in the nerves to transmit an acute pain, or before when tissue injury turns into acute pain. But over time, when you have cytokine production and prostaglandin production and continued stimulus, then that pain starts to transition into chronic pain at the bottom right-hand side of your screen. And you can see some of the actual physical changes or physiologic changes that happen to our cells and also happen to our receptors when that pain goes from an acute stage to a chronic stage. When we talk about, when we take a step back and talk a little bit more simply from a time standpoint, a lot of times the easiest way to explain this to patients is based on time. And so we often think of acute pain as pain that lasts for 4 weeks or less. It's normally after an acute injury. And as healing happens, acute pain should improve. From 4 weeks to 12 weeks, I think that's really a critical period. And as I work with surgeons, I'm now working to get patients in to see us when the minute they see that pain start to transform into a subacute pain, or that pain continues to stay the same or ramp up when healing is starting to occur, then I actually want to start seeing them, because you can oftentimes prevent that transition from subacute pain to chronic pain. Then pain that lasts longer than 12 weeks, by definition, is chronic pain. And a lot of those changes that I showed in the previous slide have normally happened by that point. Another way to classify pain is based on origin. So nociceptive pain is pain that we're all familiar with. That's the I slammed my hand in a car door type pain. It arises from actual tissue damage or threatened tissue damage. If you hold your hand too close to a fire, then you'll have nociceptive pain before you actually burn yourself. And those are trauma, surgeries, arthritis, any kind of physical damage to your periphery that causes pain. Neuropathic pain occurs from a lesion in your central nervous system or in your peripheral nervous system. So if you have carpal tunnel disease, which is compression of a peripheral nerve, if you have sciatica or lumbar radicular pain, which is compression of a nerve root, or you have peripheral neuropathy, then that is a neuropathic pain. Nociplastic is a relatively new term, and it's really almost inflammatory pain, and it arises from altered nociception. And it can happen when there's sometimes no clear evidence of tissue damage. It's very much influenced by biopsychosocial factors, which we will discuss in a moment. And best examples of this are fibromyalgia or some of the complex regional pain syndromes, which I unfortunately see a lot of. So there are some either disease states or characteristics that can potentially increase the risk of developing chronic pain. And if you want to read more about this, then you can look at the articles that are at the bottom of the screen. But patients who have certain genetic factors, patients who have certain beliefs, there are certain nutritional factors, and we can talk for days about what is the diet that a chronic pain patient should eat? That's something that I actually discuss a lot in my clinic. But there are certain factors that can increase the risk of developing chronic pain. And so I'm actually going to pass the discussion to my colleagues. And I want to start with Dr. Shatman and really ask about what are some misconceptions about chronic pain and opioid misuse that you see in your practice, or that you see, or that you talk about when you're teaching fellows at NYU?
Boy, I spend a number of hours with my fellows answering this one question. I think one of the important misconceptions regarding chronic pain and opioid misuse is that patients are started off on high dosages of opioids, and that's a mistake to begin with. Well, it is a mistake. The other thing that happens is that patients start off on low doses of opioids and then escalate. And there's a lot of reasons for this misconception. But way back when, in the early 2000s, we talked about start low, go slow. The world of opioid analgesia and chronic pain has changed dramatically, but that's always a good mantra. I think very few doctors out there are starting off being high or irresponsible prescribers.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. And I think education has improved, and I would say opioid practice have improved because of webinars like this and education that happens around the country. Dr. Singh, same question. Kind of, what are some misconceptions that you continue to see, and maybe even patient misconceptions about chronic pain that you see in your practice?
So I would say one of the biggest ones is that we don't use opioid at all for chronic pain. We do use it when it's going to be helpful for the patient and when we see relief with the opioids. And we know that there is a chance that we can provide better quality of life and improved function to the patient with the use of opioid medications. In those cases, we do use it. That's where I see the most sort of misconception in the current generation when it comes to the chronic pain treatment with opioid medications.
Yeah, and I think based on what both of you said, there is a question from the audience that I actually want to throw out here. It's a little bit of a shift, but it's kind of, can either of you kind of talk about, I think we can go by first names. We're all friends here. Michael, you talked about kind of that start low, go slow mentality, and someone's asked about how do you pick that right dose for someone who's opioid naive? Like, how do you select the right opioid? Like, how do you get someone started who may need opioids, as Dr. Singh said?
Wow, that's a great question. Again, I think that most people who are prescribed opioids for acute pain are initially prescribed the lowest possible dosage. That should be done simply remembering that the dosage can be altered. We also have to consider things as complex and outside the scope of this webinar, such as pharmacogenomics, which are rarely described. Basically, 5 milligrams of morphine to me, or say hydrocodone, may be like 10 milligrams to Dr. Singh. She may be an ultra rapid or ultra slow metabolizer. So again, I think that the starting doses of opioids, it's somewhat arbitrary, but I've seen plenty of patients get that initial low dosage and do well with that initial low dosage, which is going to be less risky than an initial high dosage.
Yeah, Dr. Singh, can you also comment on that? How do you, patient walks into your practice and they're having chronic radicular pain and you decide they need to be on opioids, but they're opioid naive. How do you start?
So I kind of, in general, when I'm thinking of opioids for chronic pain, there are certain things that are important. Presence of a clear anatomical source of pain is important. We know that there are certain disease types like non-specific low back pain or fibromyalgia where opioids are not going to give us good results. And then I would first go with my conservative methods, physical therapy, non-opioid medications, injections. And if despite doing all that, patient is in moderate to severe pain that is impacting patient's function or quality of life, then I will consider opioid in a case-by-case basis. And it is a bit of a relationship and trust to see which direction we want to go, how motivated is patient in getting better. I have become a fan of buprenorphine patch for starting opioids now because most of my patients with chronic pain have kind of constant pain. It's not that they're having pain only for a couple hours of the day. So I tend to start with buprenorphine patch, 5 micrograms per hour. That also works great for neuropathic pain and works on other receptors beyond opioid. It's beyond just mu opioid agonism and does not have respiratory depression. So that's where I typically start, and I'll titrate up. I tend to, in general, stay in that category. Depending on patient, case by case basis, I would consider other opioid medications. But in general, I try to stay below a certain level, below 20, 50 milligram morphine equivalents if I'm starting the opioids for non-cancer related pain, because there might be other tools that I may be open to trying more, such as spinal cord stimulator and other implants that may be able to help the patient. And of course, these rules don't apply for cancer pain. If it is cancer pain, then we do whatever we need to do to control pain. And in those cases, I may go to opioids quicker. I'm not going to go step by step because I need to control the pain as quickly as possible so that patient can get to their treatment. Opioids are one of the strongest pain medications that we have, and it does tend to work pretty quickly. So I can get reliable pain relief quickly for my cancer patients with opioids.
Yeah, I think just to sum it up, I think I agree with both of you, and I think there's many ways to start. I think low and slow, starting safe, many ways to roam. I often start with hydrocodone. I like to start with short acting with my patients, and then I would say the majority of my patients who are on long acting, I titrate to methadone. Shout out to Pat Bowman, who was kind of the person who taught me that. But yeah, I think there's a lot of ways to do it. I think the main thing is kind of making sure patients are safe and making sure you're starting slow and escalating properly. I wanted to talk a little bit and cover the biopsychosocial model of pain. And we talked a lot about the top left side, the biologic side, finding pathology, as Dr. Singh said, diagnosing, treating inflammation and chronic disease. But Dr. Chapman, can you talk about the other points in the wheel of the biopsychosocial model?
Oh, happy to, Jonathan. So in the upper right is psychological, and there are certain conditions that are very common among chronic pain patients. These certainly include depression and anxiety, which are not going to do anything good for quality of life and are going to make pain experience greater. Also important is catastrophizing, because that's been linked to poor outcomes. And depression, anxiety generally, and certainly catastrophization can be addressed through cognitive behavior therapy, which is very effective and generally a time-limited treatment. Going down to the lower left-hand corner, the behavioral, a lot of our patients are not necessarily doing themselves favors by or through their behavioral responses to their pain, and even in many cases with behaviors that predate their pain. For example, nutrition and diet. We've done a lot of work with anti-inflammatory diet and how that affects pain experience, sleep. Way back when I started in the 80s, the psychiatrist would say, give them amitriptyline. If you get them sleeping, you can get rid of half their pain. Exercise mobility, Dr. Singh mentioned that. And finally, the social realm, and that's in the lower right-hand corner. And what we know is that chronic pain develops and is maintained within a social context. And right now, social contexts are a little bit out of whack. Discrimination, stigmatization, these factors certainly come into play. There's some data that suggests that not working and receiving any kind of disability payments can come into play. So this model, which has been around for 40 some odd years, simply says, let's look at the person with pain rather than chronic pain. And to do so, we have to consider the psychological, behavioral, and social realms as well.
I mean, that was outstanding. And I think there's also a message there that I think you touched on that I wanted to highlight, and that as we treat pain, I think the conversations need to be about all four of these categories. And I think as medical physicians, we often do a really good job of treating the biological side of the pain of the biopsychosocial model. But we really have to make sure we're touching all four if we want to make sure we're having a really strong impact on patient care. We're going to move forward and we're going to talk about a patient case. And I'm going to go through it, and it's going to be a case that we're going to come back to through the presentation. This is Angelo. He's 38 years old. He fell off a ladder 2 years ago and has chronic neck and low back pain. He's been on opioids for 18 months. And he's been referred to our office or your office, or we'll say all of our office since we're going to talk about it together, because the primary care physician will no longer prescribe opioids next month. And this is an unfortunate situation that we often see where patients show up and they've been taking higher doses of opioids or moderate doses of opioids, and a physician refuses to write them, and that patient basically has to get them or face going into withdrawal. Generally healthy, no other comorbidities, unable to return to work full time. He's had epidural steroid injections in the cervical and lumbar spine. He's had a radiofrequency ablation, which is a treatment for facet-mediated pain for axial back pain. He's had an anterior cervical discectomy and fusion. He has partial relief of his arm symptoms as neck pain hasn't improved. He's hesitant to have lumbar surgery because he has a cervical surgery that really didn't provide much benefit. And I'm sure this story kind of rings true to all of us. We've seen this patient. He's now on long-acting morphine, so morphine extended release, 15 milligrams twice daily. He's on oxycodone, 5 milligrams, immediate release twice daily for breakthrough. He's on gabapentin, 300 milligrams, 3 times a day, and ibuprofen, 200 milligrams, 3 times a day as needed. And so we'll put a pin here. We'll come back to this case. But now I'm going to ask a question to Dr. Singh, kind of looking, the slide in the background talks about a comprehensive pain assessment. But can you talk a little bit about how you would assess pain comprehensively in a patient like this?
Sure. This is what I do every day. So it really starts with history, a thorough history. And as simple as, I'm surprised, when we're talking about pain, how people miss what makes it better, what makes it worse. You can get so much information from that. What makes the pain better? What makes the pain worse? So if somebody has lower back pain that's worse with walking and standing for a long period of time and gets better with sitting, your mind is thinking lumbar stenosis, neurogenic claudication related pain. If somebody's having pain with the daily activities of like brushing their teeth or washing dishes, that might be more myofascial pain. There may be weak spinal muscles going on here. So that's really important. What is the pain characteristic? What is the location? Does it radiate anywhere or not? And then after we have that, now that this the plot is building, the next, then now that I have some differential in my mind, I then move on to physical exam, full neurological exam. general exam, watching the patient walk. You can learn so much from the way a patient walks. And then again, like we, Dr. Guri and I both learned that from Dr. Anne-Marie McKenzie Brown. You can diagnose a lot by just watching them the way they walk. Doing the pertinent physical exam, doing the neurological strength testing. I am surprised how I notice and I have picked up on things by just doing a motor and sensory exam and checking for quick reflexes, knee reflex, and one of the reflex that we check often that's really easy is the Hoffman's reflex that tells us if the patient may have any component of cervical stenosis or cervical myelopathy, and I've picked up so many just because of the physical exam. So that's really important, and it doesn't take a long time. And then if we're thinking of specific pathology, then physical exam for the specific pathology, if I'm thinking low back pain related to SI joint, then I'll be doing SI joint maneuvers, doing hip joint maneuvers to make sure it's not coming from the hip joint. And then correlating diagnostic studies, you know, looking at what's available, but sometimes the patient may be saying, you know, low back or buttock groin pain, but it's really the hip joint that's hurting, and you may have a lumbar spine MRI, but not a hip x-ray. So what am I missing, and what do I need to get? Reviewing those. And then functional pain assessment. You know, pain is multidimensional. It affects the function as well as the mental health. And we have to remember to do the multidimensional assessment. And thank you for bringing that up. We have to go beyond numerical pain rating scale. Pain is subjective. Unfortunately, we have not discovered the pain thermometer that we can put on the patient and say, this is the pain temperature today. So we have to really use other tools that give us a global picture of how patient is doing. We know pain impacts sleep, physical function, ability to participate in social activities, and all of these can be gathered from other tools such as patient-reported outcome measures information that was developed by PROMISE measures that were developed by NIH and is a validated tool that's available for free. And it can be used across all chronic conditions. So it's not just limited to pain, and it's a tool how through which we can talk with other physicians. We all talk the same languages because all chronic diseases affect multiple aspects of life. So how is our patient truly doing going beyond the pain scores? And there are other tools available as well, such as Osvestry Disability Index, SF-36, and there may be a cost associated with pain intensity, enjoyment of life, and general activity is a really short three-question questionnaire that a lot of people use. And anxiety and depression metrics are part of PROMISE, but if you're not using them, then certainly patients with chronic pain need to be screened for depression or anxiety because often it's affecting it both. And it's not that we're saying that if the patient has depression or any other mental health condition, their pain is not real. No, we have to, it is, they're both real and we have to treat them both together, and they're probably making each other worse. Pain is making the depression worse and depression is making the pain worse. And we have to realize that, and we have to treat them side by side. You can't just treat one and not the other. It's not uncommon for when you really go through these questions, you know, for patients to tell you how they're suffering. And it's interesting, we have the PHQ 9 that's a questionnaire to screen for depression. It's not uncommon for patients to sometimes come and tell me, if I was to ask, you know, do you have any thoughts of harming yourself? They'll say like, yes, I would rather not be alive than live with this pain. And it becomes challenging when the patients say that, you know, of course you have to go into then assessing how real, you know, is the threat? Are they, do they have a plan? And you may want to go make sure that somebody's checking on the patient that day. And actually would love to hear Dr. Shapman's thought on that. Like if a patient comes and says that they would rather, they would be better off dead, how do you handle that situation?
That's a tough one. That's a tough one, Vinita. You know, the good news is that data were released today indicating that homicide deaths are down in this country, which is the first downturn in quite a while. Bad news is that suicide deaths are up. Suicide's real and it happens, and it happens more commonly among patients with chronic pain. One of the real problems that we've been dealing with for the last 7, 8 years is non-consensual tapering off of opioids in patients who are compliant, adherent, stable otherwise, simply because hospital systems decided they had to cut people off of opioids. It was, you know, what was in vogue, unfortunately. And Dr. Stefan Cortez down at University of Alabama, Birmingham, has some very disturbing data on how closely the association is, how strong the association is between non-consensual involuntary tapers and actual completed suicides. So in this day and age, you know, the PHQ, the ninth question, the last question on it, does pertain to suicide. You know, if you're going to err and talk about suicidality with a patient, err in the degree, in the direction of caution. And you don't necessarily have to say, are you going to actively, you know, kill yourself today, tomorrow, the next day? You know, one of the things that I did for years practicing, say, things along the lines of, boy, having chronic pain and going through what you're going through is got to be amazingly difficult. What is it that keeps you going during all this? And it's interesting because people talk about their children and their grandchildren. And I don't know, the average psychologist loses 2 patients to suicide during a career. And I've been doing this for about 39 years. And I guess I've really just been lucky, lucky and cautious and haven't lost any. But it is a reality. So again, my takeaway is to take suicidality seriously and to try to stay away from taking all quality of life providing or enhancing treatments away from patients simply because it's not considered good form anymore.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. And I want to actually pose this question to both of you. I'll start with Vinita and then go back to Michael. Are there any standardized screening tools, and we just talked about a few, that you use in your practice, you know, that are, that you use at Emory or that you've used at NYU?
A screening tool for patients assessment in general?
Yeah, just for assessment in general. Like if you have a patient who comes in the clinic, is there anything you have them fill out? Is there anything that would prompt you to potentially bring out a screening tool? Is there anything that's in your electronic medical record, et cetera?
Yeah, so we do all the patients coming to the pain clinic and they fill out certain questionnaires. One of them is just our new patient questionnaires that are designed to go over the history that what makes the pain better, what makes the pain worse, location, radiation, and it also includes kind of what all have they tried in terms of non-pharmacological treatment, physical therapy, and then pharmacological treatments and interventional treatment, because that gives us a good starting point. So we are a tertiary referral center. So when we get the patient, they have often tried a lot of things. So we need to know kind of what all has already been tried. So then we can think of and then come with a better answer for the patient as to what could be a next step. The other questionnaires that they fill out is PROMISE 29. I'm a big fan of PROMISE 29 because it is a global health measure, and it has 29 questions and includes one on pain intensity. And it has then 7 subdomains and 4 questions in each subdomain. And these subdomains include anxiety, depression, pain interference, physical function, sleep disturbance, and social participants, Participation. And the good news is that all of these subdomains can be analyzed separately. So that really gives me a high-level picture of how is the patient doing. And I've often found the pain score not to correlate with my PROMIS measures. And that really tells me, sometimes the patients will say, they'll put down the pain score as 3, and I'll look at the PROMIS subdomains, and their physical function is severely limited. Those are helpful. We are still using opioid risk tool. So we have some data on that for all of our patients. If the patients are on opioids, then sometimes we'll use calm or other measures.
Yeah, same question for you, Michael.
Well, again, depends on what we're wanting to measure. I'm a psychologist. We want to measure everything in the world. I like giving a measure screening for borderline personality, given that borderline personality is overrepresented in the chronic pain population based on a review of reviews by, anywhere from 10 to 15 fold. And these are the patients that oftentimes are extremely challenging for all clinicians. And then, certainly screening for opioid appropriateness, opioid risk, I think is part of any good pain practice. And, what I like to use is the screen and opioid assessment for patients with pain, REVISE, or the SOAR, which is a free tool, which is outstanding. It takes about 5 minutes to take and 3 minutes to score. But it's absolutely outstanding psychometrically. The problem tool was actually developed by a good friend of mine, Dr. Lynn Webster, who's been a leader in the pain world for many, many years. And that was the opioid risk tool, which is only 5 items. Unfortunately, it kind of focuses heavily on women sexually abused during childhood. And, after a lot of years of use, because it was so short, and because Dr. Webster is such a rich character in American pain medicine, it was studied on a pain clinic population and was found not to be invalid, only invalid, but actually measuring the opposite of what it's supposed to be measuring. And subsequently, Dr. Webster warned people to not use this invalid tool anymore, yet they've continued to use it because it's short and quick and the word hasn't gotten out. So it's very unfortunate. And I think it's evidence that screening is important, but it's only as good as the tools with which we're screening, and they have to be well validated.
Yeah, and I think that comes to another point, and it's really the point that and our EMR has opioid risk tool baked into it. We can't prescribe opioids unless we fill out opioid risk tool. I think there's a lot of hospital systems that are built in like that, or have built-in opioid workflows like that. And whether you use SOAR or whether you use another risk tool, it's not a determinant of whether someone should be prescribed opioids. And I think that's something we're going to get into in a second. It is a determinant of risk. And I think that when I see someone that's at high risk, one, I tell the patient that I think that you're at a little bit of a higher risk, and I'll tell them the reasons why. And then as I prescribe them opioids, I may monitor them a little more closely. And I know that we're going to talk about monitoring it a little bit, and no one knows the monitoring literature better than Michael Chapman, who's on this call. But I think that really understanding when you should see patients back, when you should potentially get urine drug screening, when you should do pill counts, all the things to properly monitor and make sure that someone's safe. And I'd even say it sometimes can maybe make me think about what I'm prescribing and in what increments I'm prescribing. Just to answer this question for my practice, we also use PROMIS. We use a computer adapted version of PROMIS that we actually built into Epic and that we actually sold to Epic. So Anyone who has Epic can actually get that for their shop. And we have iPads in our clinic and we have our patients fill that out. It's something that allows us to track it over time. I know Jason Pope has done a lot of work really defining what PROMIS scores look like for a chronic pain patient and has published that. We published what chronic pain or what PROMIS scores look like for a patient who has had, who is either a candidate for a spinal cord stimulator trial or who has had a successful spinal cord stimulator trial. And so as we continue to study PROMIS scoring more, I think we're able to track that over time. And as the literature has kind of moved towards using PROMIS as a potential baseline, I think we'll learn about whether we're having successes or failures, not just looking at kind of the physiologic kind of part of the model of pain, but we can look at all of the pieces of the biopsychosocial model. I'm going to give a little bit more information about this patient, and then I'm going to actually toss it to Vanita and ask her a couple of questions. So this patient has, I know you just talked about Sperling's test. His Sperling's is positive. He has tenderness over C5 through C7. He also has tenderness over L4 to S1 with muscle spasm, positive straight leg pain with radicular pain on the left side, persistent weakness in the left bicep and in the wrist extensors. So even after surgery, still having weakness in the dermatomes that were potentially fused. Mild symptoms present due to a rapid taper over 3 weeks. So starting to go into withdrawal because of unfortunate, some of the things that Michael talked about, Dr. Chapman talked about, kind of a forced rapid taper. So patients having withdrawal symptoms. We have PROMIS scoring on this patient, which is awesome. It sounds like all of us would love to have that in practice. Limitations, fatigue, anxiety, moderate to high pain intensity, and we have moderate depression on a PHQ-9. And so kind of, Vanita, what would you do next for this patient? And how would you kind of, one of the questions we have in the chat, and I just want to remind everyone that we would love to answer your questions. We probably won't get to all of them. We'll try to get to as many as you can, but there's a question in the chat kind of asking about, how do you determine follow-up for a patient like this who has neuropathic pain? Like, how often do you see them? But then, like, so what would your next step be? And then how often would you follow up? And to everyone out there, don't forget that you can ask us questions in the chat.
So I'm really concerned about this patient now with some neurological deficit that I'm seeing. That needs some more investigation. What's going on here? Are we missing something? I would order an MRI for this patient, neck and lumbar spine, C-spine and lumbar spine, to really see what happened after the surgery. Why did he still have pain? And what's going on with the lower back? It sounds like, you know, he potentially may have a herniated disc pressing on his nerve roots, for which I can offer some therapies. And the weakness really bothers me. So weakness is one of the reasons why I would send the patient to see a neurosurgeon, because if the weakness is from a pinched nerve and it's just going to, and if we stay on that long, then that may potentially become an irreversible weakness. And if there is a correctable problem to the patient's pain, I want to make sure that the patient gets that option for correction. And so that's kind of the evaluation and the assessment part of it. It is also bothersome, the withdrawal symptoms and elevated anxiety that is noted here. I would ask the patients more about what are the withdrawal symptoms that he is having, you know, how long he has been having it, because withdrawal is not going to last forever. It is uncomfortable, but it's not going to last forever. However, some people also experience this mental withdrawal where now they're having increased anxiety and other symptoms or just feeling sad, and that can last longer. So really trying to kind of differentiate and see what's going on here. And I don't, again, you know, I don't have patients on high dose opioids, and in general, I believe in keeping the patients on as minimum amount of opioids as possible. And someone like this, if I am trying to taper, I would slow it down. And sometimes it may take me years, and sometimes the last 20 MMEs may just stay. It may not be possible to get them below that level. And what else can we do here? What else, what other medications is the patient taking? Is there a role for me to introduce another agent here, like duloxetine, another muscle relaxant? Is there a role for physical therapy, including kind of our multimodal approach to the patient? And I would see the patient, you know, probably in another 2 weeks to kind of keep a close eye, make sure that the weakness, it's, if the weakness starts to worsen, I may send this patient to the emergency room and get admitted so he can be on the fast track and see the neurosurgeon quicker.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. And I agree with, on this patient, I would want to follow up with him relatively quickly. I would try to get imaging as fast as possible. I try to start anti-neuropathic medication on top of the gabapentin. You know, gabapentin is normally not my first line for anti-neuropathic pain treatment. You know, the number needed to treat for gabapentin is in the sevens, unfortunately. And so I often turn to, I think that norepi and serotonin drugs are a little bit better, at least anecdotally, that I've seen in my practice. So, like you said, I'd look at Cymbalta or a TCA for this patient, see if he's sleeping. Yeah, jump in.
Yes, can I add a quick note on gabapentin? Again, the side effects of gabapentin can be brutal, the cognitive side effects, and patients cannot like them. But the patients who I've treated who've done the best have been those who are characterologically highly anxious. And we find the central nervous system depression that comes from gabapentin is actually soothing to these people. And I've seen people get put onto, you know, fairly high, you know, 3,000 milligrams plus a day of gabapentin, and interestingly, voluntarily reduce their opioids because they were likely escalating dosages of opioids partially as a form of chemical coping. But if the gabapentin allows them to do the same thing, then, you know, again, we have to remember that, you know, each patient is an individual, and some patients actually do quite well with gabapentin.
Yeah, no, I, as part of the reason I love having conversations with you is I learn something every time. And that was a good nugget. And continuing on with this patient, you know, I'd probably see him pretty regularly. And I think one of the conversations I would have, especially if he had real lesions on his MRI, is what are his concerns about surgery and can we have a real conversation about them? Because this patient may need a surgeon because of their weakness. Of course, the number one contraindication to anything is medicine is not wanting to have it, which is patients have autonomy. And so if the patient decides they don't want surgery, then we would talk about other options, which we can go over a little later in the presentation. Kind of moving forward, you know, I think this is a good time, and I'll pass it to you, Michael, to talk a little bit about the challenges of the 2016 guidelines and the misapplications of them and how patients can end up in this situation where they're actually showing up to a clinic partially in withdrawal.
Well, I think I've written so many articles on the misapplication and weaponization of the 2016 CDC guideline that neither of you would get a word in otherwise if I covered it all. But one point I would like to make, one brief point, is that around this diamond or snowflake, not really sure what it is, but there's a lot of different players who are listed. And I'm not going to go into all of them, but, you know, we have to look at a couple as being very important. With the weaponization or misapplication of the guideline, regulators, law enforcement, including the DEA, state medical boards as regulators, were given open season on physicians prescribing, and not just high dosage opioids, but moderate opioid dosages. And that caused a lot of problem. That resulted in a chilling effect on physicians generally. Every time the DEA raided a pill mill or a legitimate physician, it would have a chilling effect on other prescribers because they were afraid that the boogeyman was coming after them next. Healthcare providers were put in a very difficult position because most healthcare practices are now owned by corporations of sorts. And, what we've seen on a large scale is large healthcare systems adopt no chronic opioid policies. What does that mean for the provider and for the patient? It meant that the provider had to go to the patient and say, I know you're doing really well with opioids. You've always been adherent. You've been stable, but I have to take you off them now. So again, a lot of people were put into a very uncomfortable bind by this. And, we're starting to see a little bit of loosening, but, and that little bit of loosening, I think, is really good because if we do a better job selecting patients, then we won't have to worry about a misapplied draconian guideline.
Yeah, and I'll just kind of continue that, and as we see, I think the goal of the guidelines was to decrease opioid prescribing, or no, I shouldn't say the goal, but the weaponization of the guideline was to
That was
decrease
the
opioid.
goal. That was the goal.
Yeah, the goal was to decrease opioid prescribing, and that goal was successful, but decreasing opioid prescribing didn't necessarily have the impacts on opioid overdose deaths that we thought that it would. And a lot of that is because we had patients who ended up in the situation like our patient who we're discussing today. Vanita, I want to pass it to you and kind of ask you about kind of changes that you've seen either in your practice or around your practice or around policies that are directly related to the 2016 guidelines.
So, like you're mentioning, like it was kind of blown out of proportion. It wasn't meant to replace clinical judgment and individualized treatment, but it somewhat happened. It was never intended for cancer patients, but those patients also started to see the impact of these guidelines. And then just guidelines converting into laws, which was again not the intention of the CDC guidelines, but laws being passed and pharmacies not releasing medication to the patients and insurance providers stopped covering for certain medications, then just becoming really hard for your patients to get these medications such that sometimes, feel like it's just too burdensome to continue these medications. And the worst is for our cancer patients. If I have a patient with head and neck cancer who does not have an oral route and is in severe pain, and I have made the clinical judgment based on what they're tolerating so far to start on a low-dose fentanyl patch, 12 micrograms, because it's transdermal, I can't do that because I haven't shown that they have failed oral hydrocodone and oral oxycodone first. So it's just, that has been the biggest impact. It is kind of limiting your clinical practice with what can the patient get and cannot get. And just the number of prior authorizations have just gone through the roof that, for some of them, as you were mentioning, I don't, for some weird reason, it seems to be methadone for you, but for us, definitely all the buprenorphine-based products, they always require prior authorization, but it is more healthcare, providers required to achieve the same goals that you wanted before.
Yeah, and I'll just throw one out there just to add to the conversation. I took a family member to a doctor's appointment about 3 years ago, and there was a sign in the office that said that we don't treat pain. And that was one of the saddest moments I've seen, just because pain is why people go to the doctor. Pain is our warning system that something is wrong. And so if we don't treat pain as physicians, then we're not treating patients and we're not treating disease. So, kind of moving forward, Dr. Singh, can you quickly kind of go through some of the changes that happened with the 2022 CDC guidelines?
Yeah, and so the biggest change and focus with this 2022 guidelines were on individualized person-centered care and making sure that people understand that the guidelines are there to guide. They are not to replace the clinical judgment, and really the patient care should, for pain should be multimodal. multidisciplinary approach that includes the non-pharmacological treatment, physical and behavioral health, and then also the pharmacological aspect, the non-opioids and opioids when it's necessary, and what is a long-term plan. And the overall goal is to address health inequities by using culturally appropriate communication and ensuring access to care.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for that. And now we're going to move into the treatment category. And before we do that, we're going to watch a clip from a patient who's really sharing their experience with pain management after a back surgery.
I was diagnosed with complex regional pain syndrome after a back surgery. After the surgery, I began experiencing a lot of pain, shooting what I called lightning bolts of pain down my foot, really localized in my big toe. My foot was numb. My leg was partially numb. My surgeon had prescribed gabapentin for the pain, but it really wasn't enough. It got to the point where I couldn't sleep at night. I would have these shooting pains in my foot that would wake me up. So I was almost out of my mind with sleep deprivation. I couldn't put a sock or a shoe on my foot. My foot was so sensitive. I couldn't have a bed sheet, just a light bed sheet on my foot. It was too sensitive for that. It got to the point where I couldn't do physical therapy at home at all. It was just too painful. My surgeon referred me to a pain management specialist who diagnosed me with complex regional pain syndrome and adjusted my medication. He also prescribed physical therapy and desensitization physical therapy. The medications helped. The increased dose of gabapentin helped. Once the duloxetine kicked in, that was a really big difference. And I was able to really engage in more traditional physical therapy, and the pain was vastly decreased. I was able to sleep. The shooting pain went away. My quality of life was improved quite a bit.
And that was a really powerful story. And unfortunately, we see patients like that every day. And in my clinical practice, I saw three patients with complex regional pain syndrome today. Dr. Singh, can you know, we also have a question in the audience about multimodal approaches to pain care. Can you talk a little bit about kind of non-pharmacologic, pharmacologic, how you bring everything in to treat chronic pain?
Certainly, they're all pieces of puzzle. And that's what I usually tell my patient, that it will not be one thing that will treat all your pain. Pain is multidimensional, and we will have to treat the pain with pieces of puzzle that we're going to take from the non-pharmacological treatment. And then when it comes to pharmacological treatment, various agents in the pharmacological section. And then if that's not enough, we may even use interventions and procedure when it may be necessary. Almost all patients can use CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. Unfortunately, we are quite limited with insurance coverage for those kind of treatment, even though it has the most evidence for pain. It's very limited into terms of who you can offer this. There are certainly things that are still available easily over the counter, like a transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation device, TENS device, that the patients can buy from Amazon, Walmart, and they can use it for almost any pain, and really easy to use for, and they get it for about $30. So those options are available. Physical therapy, almost everybody, I tell my patients, you know, with chronic pain, it's not one-time thing. It's not like we did the physical therapy after you had the surgery, you did it and we're done. We're suffering from chronic pain forever. So it's almost like you have to repeat the physical therapy every year or so, because you, just like you take your car to the mechanic for servicing, you've got to take your body to the physical therapist every so often. So those are really important pieces of my non-pharmacological treatment. And then acupuncture, it has been started to being covered by multiple insurance providers now, and has good evidence for certain conditions like osteoarthritis. Certainly, those are the limitations that are listed here. You know, there's not a standardization of these various types of therapies as to when to use it and what dosages and how often. So there's a lot of variability when it comes to the non-pharmacological therapies. And if there's not a whole lot of guidance from the provider, the patients may not be adherent to these treatments. So I really try to review these treatments during my treatment and make sure during my visit and make sure the patient understands that's part of my treatment plan. And I get better results that way. Certainly it matters, you know, is the patient willing to do it or not? And some may be more motivated, than others, when trying these non-pharmacological treatments. And if that doesn't work, then we move on to pharmacotherapy. And pharmacotherapy, we got a ton of non-opioid options beyond Tylenol and NSAIDs. Of course, I can't use, NSAIDs like ibuprofen and naproxen for chronic pain, but I do tend to use selective COX-2 inhibitors like meloxicam or Celebrex if the patient doesn't have a significant cardiac history and they don't have kidney disease. I do tell the patients that if they're going to use the Tylenol or meloxicam, try to still have 1 or 2 days where they're not taking it, so just to kind of give their body a chance of, you know, freedom from those medications and take it as needed. And then, like Dr. McGree was mentioning, you know, SNRIs actually and TCAs work really well for our pain. These and medications just like gabapentinoids can take 6 to 8 weeks to fully kick in. So it's really important to educate our patients that it's not going to be like the oxycodone if they had taken that before. It's not going to be that strong or that quick, but we've got to give it time. The pain is chronic. We've been dealing with this pain for years. And to get to a reasonable time, it's probably going to take me several months, you know, before we are at a somewhat reasonably well-controlled goal. And then there are topical options available. There's 8, in addition to topical over-the-counter capsaicin, there's 8% capsaicin patch available that is approved for diabetic peripheral neuropathy and postherpetic neuralgia in the United States. And I've also found it covered for other neuropathic pain as well. And then muscle relaxants. And some muscle relaxants like baclofen may also help with neuropathic pain. And it's important to kind of, again, monitor these medications and choose sort of different pieces of puzzle.
And thank you for that. And I'll just tie a bow on this question because I think it'll answer a couple of questions in the audience. You know, someone asks, can you give an example of a multimodal approach used for back pain? And I think it's exactly what Dr. Singh said. I think, you know, we do procedural things, so radiofrequency ablation or epidurals, depending on if it's facetogenic pain or if it's pain due to stenosis. I'll often prescribe an antineuropathic if there's a neuropathic pain component. We'll definitely use physical therapy and anti-inflammatories if there's an inflammatory component. I'm a big believer in acupuncture. I get it myself. One of my former partners, Dr. Carrie Hyde, who I've worked with before on webinars such as this, is an acupuncturist. I refer her patients all the time. And then we also talk about diet and exercise. And it's really a combined program to get patients back into their life. Kind of going back into our next slide, we covered this some, and we talked about some of the challenges with changes to the 2016 guidelines, how a lot of times opioid risk tool and other risk tools really are there to stratify risk. Michael talked about how the opioid risk tool actually didn't do a good job of stratifying risk and may have done the opposite. But even the other tools we have stratify risk, but they don't tell us whether we should prescribe or not. And so we really have to make sure that we treat patients and give them what they need and use the tools we have at our disposal to understand how to properly ensure that patients are safe. I won't spend much time on this, but, you know, I always say no matter how your feeling is on opioids, if I leave today and I get in a car accident and I end up in the emergency room, I pray that someone has the mercy on me to give me an opioid so that I can feel better. Because opioids really work well for acute pain. I think we should, consider starting low and make sure that we're appropriate. Pain that isn't severe, we can use Tylenol and ibuprofen potentially for NSAIDs, or acetaminophen and ibuprofen. But otherwise, if patients are having really severe pain, I think we should use opioids. And post-surgical pain is really the best example of that, of really using opioids. Yeah, and as we continue opioids for chronic pain, it's really seeing patients at regular intervals. I see my patients at least every 3 months, but I often start by seeing them monthly. We track their scores at every single visit. We evaluate for risk, but then we make a decision on whether the patient needs a subspecialty referral if they're getting opioids. And I often think that we should also be make sure, as we said, that we're not just treating the biologic side of pain, that we're also having conversations about their social life, their potential treatment for anxiety, depression. Can we diet and lifestyle modifications? And I've even started prescribing some of the injectable drugs that like to help with weight loss for GLP-1 drugs for patients, because I think that can be a part of the full picture. I want to pass the floor to Michael and really allow him to talk about a couple of things. This idea of opioid moderatism, but also to talk about kind of, Dr. Singh talked about how opioids and insurance, and we're having a lot of issues in Arkansas with pharmacies who are either out of medications or refusing to dispense medications. Can you talk about how that has contributed to the problem also?
Oh, certainly. Thank you, Jonathan. So opioid moderatism is titled an article that a colleague of mine at Harvard and I wrote in 2019. And in regard to chronic pain, our position, simply put, is that opioids aren't great medications for chronic pain. They're fraught with side effects, abuse potential, other iatrogenic complications. But, right now, and we're certainly seeing this in New York City and throughout the East Coast, actually, physicians and patients aren't together making decisions about treatments. Insurance is making decisions. And this will include saying something that has been around and has had 75 articles published on it, demonstrating its efficacy, is now all of a sudden experimental. A lot of you listed prior authorizations as one of the things that makes pain practice hard at this point. And it is very hard, makes all practice hard. As long as insurance is calling shots, multimodal treatment, while the ideal, is not going to necessarily be a reality. And as a result, we cannot afford to write opioids out of our armamentarium because, as Dr. Gurry pointed out, God forbid he's in an auto accident, he's going to have opioids. But even for chronic pain, while they're not great medications, they're very imperfect, to say the least. We need to keep them around because they're better than just letting a patient suffer with no treatment. Doing so violates the Hippocratic Oath. I teach medical ethics as well as pain medicine and believe strongly in the right to reasonable analgesia.
I agree with you 100%. And, I'm going to put a pin here, I want to cover a couple of questions in the chat and then kind of go back into our conversation. There was a clarifying question on capsation for diabetic peripheral neuropathy. There is of course over-the-counter capsaicin cream that has been used for a number of pain conditions, and then there is now a capsaicin patch that's 8% that has been approved for diabetic peripheral neuropathy that we are able to now. It has to be placed in the office by a healthcare provider, and the studies have shown some efficacy. And feel free to read those studies on your own. There is also a question about low-dose naltrexone, and one of my good friends, Neil Mehta, kind of encouraged me to start prescribing low-dose naltrexone, and I prescribe it for a lot of my patients who have fibromyalgia and other kind of nociplastic pain conditions. Continue to move forward. I'll kind of continue the story with Angelo, and I have a couple of questions for Dr. Singh. Vinita, I know you talked about referring him potentially to neurosurgery, but would he be someone who would benefit from spinal cord stimulation? Should we continue to taper his meds? I think you touched on that. And are there other mental health goals that we should potentially have for him?
Yeah, I think yes to all of those. Yes, I mean, if somebody has failed some conservative injections like epidural steroid injections and others, and for a lot of conditions, low back and leg pain, and even now for nociceptive pain conditions, we are able to offer good pain relief with neuromodulation techniques like spinal cord stimulators or peripheral nerve stimulators. We use peripheral nerve stimulators if the patient has pain in one to two nerve distribution. For a central pain, we would have to use spinal cord stimulator. And the good thing with this is that with the spinal cord stimulator, that there'll be a trial, there'll be a test to see if this works or doesn't work. So if it doesn't work, then we move on to the next thing. But certainly, and all of that would be after I have confirmed that there's nothing serious that he needs to see the neurosurgeon for. How was the weakness doing? Is the weakness worsening? And what was the reason for the weakness? Was it mostly pain-limited weakness, or there is this true problem in his spine that needs some acute neurosurgical intervention? In terms of reintroducing opioids at the lower dose, especially if he's in withdrawal, yes, that is a conversation that we can have. In terms of, asking how much was the opioids helping him? If it was really helping his pain and he was more active with the opioid medications and had analgesia, I may consider a little bit. I may also consider buprenorphine-based products in him for better pain control, and then definitely adding the other supportive medications and discussing if cognitive behavioral therapy may be an option. He did have. He wasn't born with this pain, and this was after he fell off of ladders. This is not what his life has been always. So he has not, this is he will benefit from coaching about what are some ways of coping with this pain that he has that not every 38-year-old has.
Yeah, no, and I think we have to put a pin here. There's been a couple of papers and a New York Times article that have kind of pushed back on the use of neuromodulation. I think we have to comment that, some of those papers, I think I suggest everyone read them themselves, but there are some flaws there. I think also neuromodulation, just like opioids, applied correctly, can really show a lot of benefit for patients. And a lot of that is with close follow-up and monitoring and really good decision making and patient selection. And so as we use these devices, but the judicious use of these devices, really, I've seen life-changing results in patients in my own practice. Continuing forward, I wanted to touch on this really quickly, and I'll throw this to you, Michael. I'll let you rapid fire this answer in the interest of time, but if he was on cannabis, how does that change the situation?
It wouldn't necessarily, but perhaps should. Surprisingly, on a federal level, if you are prescribing a Schedule II drug with knowledge that your patient is using a Schedule I, that can put your license at risk. And you may say, well, I'm in a medical marijuana state and a recreational cannabis state, so that doesn't apply to me. And actually, it would. The good news is that it looks like the rescheduling of cannabis is going to be pretty imminent, and they're talking about pretty sure that it's going to occur in December. I hope that's true.
Hope so too. Kind of moving forward, I want to also toss this back to you because I know that you've spoken about the literature on monitoring and how that can really make sure patients are safe. So can you touch on that really briefly?
Yes. First, prescription drug monitoring programs or PDMPs in most states out there, it's law. But even in the state of Massachusetts, where I worked until recently, we had, a ton of patients, the very vast majority who received opioids, I believe this is at the dental school, almost, 95, 97% of them, there was no PDMP consulting. That's just a mistake. There's all this good information right there. It's free. It's off in the law. Check it. In terms of urine drug screening, I've done a lot of research on this, people say, well, cannabis is something that's better than opioids, and we need to give everyone cannabis. Yet, we did a study, I believe it was 2019, in pain medicine that found that those patients who tested positive in their initial urine drug screen were 2.5 times more likely over the following year on opioids to be non-adherent with their opioid prescriptions. So, I think that people are reluctant to urine drug screen in too many cases. We've also published a paper around the same time finding that the more you test, the lower the likelihood of aberrancy. So, again, these are the gold standard risk mitigation tools. Please use them. They can save patients' lives. They can save your practices.
I agree with you 100%. I also appreciate your shout out to the state laws. I know the laws in New York and Massachusetts, as you said, are very different than the laws in Georgia and very different than the laws in Arkansas. So make sure that you fully understand those laws and also understand the federal laws when it comes to cannabis. For example, in Arkansas, you have to see a patient in person if you're going to titrate their medication up or down. And so every state has their own rules and their own laws that some are based on the 2016 guidelines and may be for good or bad patient care. But either way, in order to protect your license, make sure you understand what those laws are. And that also holds true for telemedicine, where in some states you can use telemedicine to really kind of titrate and prescribe opioids, and they can be instead of an in-person visit. In some states, you can't do that. And also, we need to make sure that we educate patients on safe storage. In Arkansas, the law is that you have to prescribe naloxone at least once a year to anyone who's on chronic opioids. And so I think it's standard of practice to make sure people understand how to use it. And I was fortunate to really help champion that law as a physician sponsor. Of course, shared decision making. And I think this is something that was lost in kind of the blowback from the 2016 guidelines. We made decisions that patients need to taper, and really it should be a shared decision-making model and helping patients understand the risk and challenges of opioids. And if opioids aren't working, then pointing that out to patients and coming to a conversation about what's best for their care. And as we talk about tapers, and if we do tapers with patients, I think as we talk about kind of up titrating medications, it should be low and slow. Tapers, unless we really believe someone is at risk, we also should be moving low and slow and not sacrificing really pain control in order to get patients off of opioids. And so sometimes tapers may take a year. I often will see patients back who I'm tapering either up or down on medications every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks, so I can understand the risk benefits and side effects, and so we can adjust the doses as we move forward. And I really also think it's important to make sure patients have support if you do decide have a shared decision maker to taper a patient. And a lot of that is A, to make sure patients are safe, and naloxone is a part of that. Also, following up with them to make sure their pain is under control, if they need a specialist, and if someone has it needs medication-assisted treatment for some reason, or you feel that they're unsafe, making sure that you're taking care of their mental health, making sure that you're also using other modalities to control their pain, and that may be referral to specialists. And lastly, really making sure that they have support, and some of that support may be a support group. It may be a psychologist. It may be a counselor. It may also be that that patient just needs some encouragement. And now I wanted to touch on opioid use disorder as one of our goals. And Dr. Singh, can you talk a little bit about the DSM-5 criteria? And I know that Dr. Chapman, you have some disagreements with this criteria, so I'll come to you after that.
So, It's really important to, first know that the term addiction is no longer used because of the stigma associated with it. And it's sort of replaced by substance use disorder, and you can replace substance by any opioid use disorder, cannabis use disorder, whatever the substance might be. And then here, are listed all the criteria for diagnosing opioid use disorder, OUD. Important to also note that the tolerance and withdrawal, that will just, there's a pharmacological effect of the medication, and that happens to any patient, or can happen to any patient who's receiving opioids, even as a part of the prescription plan. So that does not count if the patient is receiving opioids under medical supervision. But these are the criteria that you need to be looking for, and educating your patients about this is really important as well, so they know what to look for. Telling them that if you start having craving for this medication, that might be a sign of opioid use disorder. Or if you are missing important social engagements that you would not have missed otherwise because you're too sleepy taking this medication, but you want to take this medication. You know that this is causing side effects, severe constipation that you're not able to control, but you're still taking this medication, and taking more than what you're being prescribed. You wouldn't do that with gabapentin or any other medication where you're going to take more than prescribed. Then why do that with opioid medications? So all of these are, the criteria is listed here. If the patient has any of these two or three, they have mild opioid use disorder, and 4 to 5 is moderate, and greater than 6 is severe. And with that, I'll hand it over to Dr. Shatman.
Vanita, my friend and esteemed colleague, I'm going to respectfully agree to disagree. Just like the CDC 2016 guideline was weaponized, the OUD diagnosis has been weaponized too. And this is all pushed by the same anti-opioid zealots who sat on the 2016 guideline committee and hijacked that. A lot of things go on behind the scenes, so I'm just going to respectfully disagree.
And I will say, if you have a patient who you feel is unsafe and, has, biologic and has challenges tapering off opioids, and you feel that they may need treatment, then there's a few options. There's buprenorphine, which is or buprenorphine naloxone, which is a partial agonist. There's methadone, which is a full agonist. And there's naltrexone, which is an antagonist. But I would say, there's been liberalization of the ability to prescribe these medications. But I also think that prescribing them, they should go hand in hand with some sort of mental health treatment and making sure that patients are, and again, making sure that they're safe. I'm going to, in the presentation part of our time together, by going over SMART goals, and these are goals that are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely, and are intended to be put into action and you can put into practice starting tomorrow, incorporating these biopsychosocial behavioral factors in the comprehensive pain assessment, aligning treatment choice to pain origin and understanding nociceptive neuropathic and nociplastic pain, limit new opioid prescribing to patients with severe pain, and use short-acting agents as the lowest effective dose. Again, as Michael said, starting low and slow. Assessing patients, monitoring risk and benefits, and integrating the 2022 CDC guidelines to the 2016 CDC guidelines as you treat patients. I want to remind everyone that if you want to ask a question, then you can select the Ask a Question tab. And we have a few that I wanted to run through. There's actually one comment that I wanted to address that said that flushing medications is no longer recommended. That's actually partially true. And so for opioid medications and most controlled medications, the ideal is to take them to either a drug take-back program or to a drug take-back box at a pharmacy. But if you don't have access to any kind of drug take-back program or drug take-back box, then the actual FDA recommendation is to actually flush opioids. Any oxycodone, hydrocodone, methadone, et cetera, there's actually a flush list on the FDA's website, and it actually lists almost all the opioids as flushable medications. And I think that's really a risk-benefit analysis to make sure that it's actually safer to flush those medicines than to leave them in a cabinet where people may have access to them. There was another question about preference for rescue opioid antagonists. And I would say oftentimes in Arkansas, we're limited by payers. I think that, you know, asking patients to give an injectable is sometimes harder than giving a nasal spray. And so if patients have access to the nasal spray, then I would say that that's what I would prescribe. But I often am not excited about requiring a patient who's on a chronic opioid, who may have a fixed income, who may have limited resources to pay $200 for an opioid antagonist. And so look into potential supplements in your state that may supplement the price. But I think it's more important to get them something than to choose the right medication and to teach them how to use whatever is most cost effective. Let's see if there's others. Someone asked a question about how do we teach emergency medicine physicians, because they find that in their community, emergency medicine physicians don't really approach pain that well. Dr. Chapman, Michael, do you want to talk about that? I think it's really inviting them to conferences like this, but I'll let you go ahead and touch on that.
Real quickly, a couple things. Number one, in fellowship programs in pain medicine, we're seeing increasingly more pain medicine, emergency medicine physicians applying to and going into fellowship programs, which is a really good sign. And then historically, emergency departments have been problematic looking at the amount of discrimination that goes on in emergency departments. Studies going back into the 90s, early 90s, finding that, you know, African Americans with long bone fractures were half as likely to receive opioid analgesia as were white patients. And they did receive it. They received only half as much. And then studies into the 2020s are mirroring the results. So we're still seeing a lot of discrimination, and I hope that progressively more emergency medicine physicians will avail themselves of formal training in pain medicine.
Yeah, and I will say there's a group called ALTO that's in New Jersey that I think is doing a lot of really good work in emergency medicine. And Vanita, I want to throw one question to you. One last question is very specific. I know you're a cancer pain specialist that was asking about pain after aromatase inhibitors for breast cancer. Any suggestions?
That's a tricky one because it's usually the diffuse arthralgia that the patients have. And again, I kind of go by how bad is this pain and is this how much is it limiting the function? I would treat that as my other, I would use here my non-opioid medications as well. Opioid medications, if I need to, here is where I would prefer to use buprenorphine if I have to. But duloxetine is something that has been my go-to in these situations. Start there. And then if that's not helpful, considering muscle relaxants and if need be, then opioid medications.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And there may be a use for low-dose naltrexone in that situation too. One last question. I'll go ahead and take it. And it's kind of asking about, when you have the duration of an initial prescription, what factors do you consider most critical and how to communicate that decision? I think it's just full honesty and transparency. That's why we use tools to assess risk. We tell patients their risk. We tell them the risk of taking opioids. I often see all my patients at least within 1 month of starting an opioid so we can assess the benefit and decide if there's assess the risk and benefit and see if it needs to be titrated up or down. Those patients have access to call me at any point and call my office if there's something, if they either feel a side effect or they feel their pain is under control and we can bring them in faster. We're going to go ahead and we're coming to the end of our time together. And so I appreciate all of you. You can find slides from this activity in the course guide under resources on the tab on this program that's on your screen. That's all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank my colleagues, Dr. Michael Chapman, Dr. Vanita Singh, Always great talking to both of you. This was an outstanding discussion. Thank you to our audience for joining today. Thank you for our sponsors for sponsoring this event. I want to thank CME Outfitters for, you know, really putting together this program. I thought it was really outstanding. Please visit our CME Outfitters Opioid Education Hub for more useful resources on pain management.